This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
And you're listening to Tech Talk, and my name is Jeff Sandhu. And earlier on the show, I had a great chat with Jessica McKellar. She's a software engineer in California who is championing the rise of Python language and even doing projects where inmates in California's prison are learning how to code. Now, as I mentioned earlier, let's speak to Luis Sanchez. He's the CEO and the founder of SGX Analytics, but he's also a data scientist, a data strategist, and a quantitative analyst. So, Luis, what exactly is a quantitative analyst?
Yes, a quantitative analyst is it's a special kind of professional in the field of finance that applies programming and math and statistics to the analysis of the capital markets, stocks, bonds, etc. So, to give you an idea, there are traders, for example, that notice patterns in the market. And these are very good traders that they have seen many conferences of, let's say, volume and price on a specific stock or a commodity. And they watch the market and they think they have what is a low risk opportunity to buy or sell, and they take positions in the market. Now, back in 1993, when I started doing this, you know, the first Pentium machine had come out. And there was no an easy way to start analyzing the validity of these empirical, let's say, empirical patterns that these traders were observing in the market. So I was one of the early guys, you know, trying to develop computer programs to backtest and analyze the validity of these patterns. And turns out that there were some that were valid, but were very infrequent, and that's how I started with this. You know, it's a nowadays the profession is a financial engineer, so it's somebody who has background in finance, but also has some statistical background and math and programming, and they deal exclusively with financial markets, and they do not look at the data sets that, for example, a data scientist looks at nowadays. But they have a very special skill, which is the analysis of data in with the time dimension, and that is very powerful. So anyway, that's how I started, you know. It was basically the combination of engineering and programming and then finance, and then the need to start looking at statistical patterns in the capital markets and see if there was any truth to what traders were observing and taking positions. And it was very interesting. You know, I did get my name out in some publications. I did play some trades for the hedge fund that were mentioned in the Washington Post, etc. So it was a fascinating time, but it was very cutting edge. I got to play with very powerful machines for the time and doing neural nets and all kind of stuff back in the early 90s.
You got involved with a lot of interesting deals, I guess, as well. You probably, you know, done stuff like, you know, film financing for Hollywood and stuff like that, I assume, as well?
Yes, but that came later on.
Right.
So basically, I was doing what's called the buy side of finance, so taking positions in the stock market and the bond markets. But in 1998, I joined AIG, which back then was top three financial institutions in the world, and a huge company based in New York, but with its origin in Asia through AIA, insurance company. So anyway, I joined a very cutting-edge group that AIG had that was called AIG Risk Finance, part of a group called Financial Products. And what they were doing in this product is very unique deals where you have to mix actuarial models and you had to mix also financial models. So we were able to take positions on almost anything. So if you were a client that had exposure to, let's say, weather, So let's say that your earnings are subject to excess, you know, sensitive to rain or drought or something of that nature, no bank can sell you a hedge against that. Mm. But AIG was able to sell insurance against these type of events, or let's say an earthquake or a tsunami happening somewhere in the world that could affect your property or your company or whatever it is. So that was a very cutting-edge group because, you know, we use a lot of computational tools to price these sort of events, you know. And that's when I became a data scientist, by switching completely from the financial models to start looking at different data sets, temperature, geological data, earthquakes, hurricanes, film financing, I mean, film receivables, credit card receivables, all kind of assets, anything that could be monetized and that could be insured, this group was looking at and trying to put deals around it.
And after your stint with AIG and also Deutsche Bank, you were then shifted as the senior vice president in Lehman Brothers.
That's right. So this is what happened. You know, this accumulation of skills in AIG made me a very valuable team member for Deutsche Bank. They actually hired me out of AIG. They were trying to put together a division to price exotic deals and things that were not traditionally done by investment banks, and in direct competition with insurance companies. So, for example, a bond that you launch to the capital markets that protects a country or a corporation against an earthquake or the financial impact of an earthquake. So I found myself pitching these deals to the government of Italy and maybe the Ministry of Finance of Italy, and then the same, his counterpart in Chile and Mexico and other parts of the world. And it became a very interesting business for Deutsche Bank. But I found myself with the idea that I could do this on my own. And so I left Deutsche Bank and started this company that was advising them, Deutsche Bank, and also Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers. And not only in these sort of deals, but other type of deals like film financing, the math and the data science that you use to analyze these exotic deals is the same. And so after a while, you know, Lehman Brothers decided that they wanted to buy my company. And I was very happy, but then they came up with a different deal. The deal is come and work for us and as a senior vice president in the high yield trading group and structuring exotic deals there, but also helping a new division that they had called Special Opportunities Group that was actually going into things like film financing and looking at all these exotic deals. So that was a great opportunity for me. And I accepted the job and started working in the main headquarters of Lehman Brothers in New York. And I was in the trading floor, and it was a fantastic job while it lasted. I had a lot of freedom to structure deals. But this was, you know, I was probably the last batch of senior VPs that was hired. And, you know, when you get hired at that senior level, there is a class and you had to attend seminars and all that. So I still keep my book, and I see my colleagues that were the last batch actually hired by Lehman Brothers. So, but it was a very exciting time, you know, aside from being in the middle of an historic event. Lehman was doing a lot of progressive stuff, and unfortunately, you know, I was this part of the financial market, the mortgage-backed securities and all of these strange derivative securities tainted a lot of the good things that were going to happen, you know. And it got delayed. I mean, sooner or later, well, somebody will come up with the stuff that we were trying to do. But, you know, what happened, I guess, for the best.
I'm speaking to Luis Sanchez, and in just a moment, we'll talk about his time at the Lehman Brothers, where they were the fourth largest investment bank in the US, and the epic collapse. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
And we're back on the line with Luis Sanchez. He's a keynote speaker at this year's PyCon APAC 2017. Luis, you were a senior vice president in Lehman Brothers and witnessed firsthand the collapse of what was the fourth largest investment bank in the US. Tell me about the story and how it all happened, as you were also right then next to the CEO, Dick Fuld, when he gave his famous speech.
Yes, that was a fascinating time. Yes, I was right there. I remember even calling my wife, you know, and then I just said, you have to listen to this. And so she was in the other side of the phone listening to the whole thing while this famous speech was happening. But, it was a very interesting situation, because as a person inside the bank and as a senior vice president, and you attend a lot of meetings with senior people on a weekly basis, and you see the exposure that this bank has and the world economy exposure to this bank, I was convinced that the government was not going to let this bank go, because the consequences were going to be terrible. We know what happened, but it happened. Now, this is what not many people know. The crisis, you know, the first bank to fall was Bear Stearns, then Lehman Brothers. And then the next one was AIG, which is very interesting because I had been there. But the exposure of AIG was huge, because precisely the division where I was working, this one I just mentioned to you, financial products and risk finance, they had a lot of exotic products that after I left, you know, they were not properly priced, you know, and so you had this division out of London that was insuring anything, basically any financial deal at a very cheap rate. But the models, actually the models were wrong. And these models were developed not taking into account a lot of the dynamics in the market. So there is a story here. You know, I mentioned initially that actuaries are very good data scientists, and they're very good mathematicians, fantastic. But in isolation, you cannot have a data scientist detached from domain expertise. That's what was happening in AIG. You have a bunch of very smart actuaries that were pricing instruments with no knowledge, with no domain expertise in the financial markets, and they were taking huge risk with no hedge. So what happened then is that they were selling insurance against events that were not properly priced. And when the thing started to collapse, when all these bonds started to default, turns out a lot of people, a lot of companies, a lot of banks had insured those deals with AIG. And they go on to AIG to try to collect, you know, the premium. They have been paying premiums. I want to collect now my insurance. AIG did not have the capability to pay. So if AIG had collapsed, then it was going to be catastrophic, more than what we saw, because the next one in line was going to be Goldman Sachs, and that's it. But the U.S. government then did something very interesting, which is they bailed out AIG. Mm. So that's an interesting story right there.
Mm. And the
interesting thing is, along all this story, the glue is that my expertise has been basically developing and assessing models using Python, you know. Mm-hmm. So the technical glue of all these elements is that I was a guy testing and developing models using Python. And actually it was less and less developing as instructing new programmers how to do it, because when you're in a senior position, you don't program that much. But after the collapse of Lehman, I got back involved into the whole thing, and now it's just a joy to me. It's just a joy to program in Python. Everything is so easy. And so I enjoy it very much. When I have time, I code, and if I don't have time, I feel like I need my fix of calling, you know. It's fascinating.
It's a silver lining despite, you know, a terrible incident to happen to so many of the staffs and employees of the Lehman Brothers. But on your side, like you mentioned, you know, it's definitely there is some, you know, good to come out of it, because your programming skills in the Python language was improved greatly because of that. And, you know, as you mentioned, like, you don't have a staff to do it anymore. You got to do it by yourself. And with that, you came up with your own company, you know?
So that's exactly what happened, you know, after the financial crisis, after Lehman collapse, I did transition to Barclays Capital, a British bank that ended up buying the assets of Lehman. But within about three months, they basically got rid of all the senior staff, you know, senior staff is expensive. And anyway, so I found myself with lots of ideas, and my friends that were still in investment banking, a few of them were in mergers and acquisitions or in analyzing the tech space, because the tech space, you know, kept going strong, and mergers and acquisitions too. So how do I plug myself in this equation? And I had this idea about creating a search engine, a semantic search engine, and, you know, indexing stuff from social media, et cetera. So back in 2010, I developed a prototype. Obviously, I started to polish my coding skills because I was a little bit rusty. But I got back into the swing of things very fast, and I started coding this prototype. And all of a sudden, I have this nice prototype search engine that was looking for things that at that time other search engines were not capable of delivering. And so, you know, that I started to put my own money there, my savings, and eventually I got a round of investments from angel investors. And then later on I got a little larger amount of capital from a hedge fund in New York. And all of a sudden I have this company, and I'm hiring data scientists, and I start talking about my search engine. But this is the interesting thing. All of a sudden, I found myself back in finance by very interesting effect. The data I was collecting from many, many different sources, I mean, I was looking at, for example, sales of items in eBay, or tracking items sold in Amazon, or, you know, let's say companies hiring people, and, you know, companies put ads in the newspapers, and then you can collect that information, and all kind of data that not necessarily is being collected by the big search engines. But having the financial background, I suddenly realized that some of these data sets were giving me a lot of insights into the earnings of companies. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I'm going to give you a great example. You know, I was tracking Groupon. Groupon is one of these American companies that sell items at discount. Mm-hmm. But the whole inventory is in front of you in the web. So if you collect this information, you have a very good idea of how much they're selling every day. And it's a public company, so you know exactly, you know, the cost structure, you know exactly how many employees they have, because you read that from financial statements. So the company basically trades in the stock market based on what it does as the top line revenue. So a Wall Street analyst guesses, basically it's a guess. You have these highly paid Wall Street analysts who are basically guessing, in the case, let's say, of Groupon or many others, but in the case of Groupon, they're going to guess what the earnings are going to be for, let's say, next quarter. Mm. Now, this is an interesting thing. When the company closes the quarter, there is about 2 month period before they announce how much they actually made in the previous quarter, right? It's a whole 2 months. If a guy like me, who has the data science background, but also the financial background, is tracking every sale that they make every day, I don't need to guess. I know. So this is a fascinating thing. It's this insider trading. And there are some people saying, well, you have some sort of information that is not public. So I have a very good law firm here in New York, and this is perfectly fine. We're just entering a new era, right, where little pieces of information in isolation are not telling you anything. But when you aggregate them, and you do have in domain expertise, can give you an edge in the stock market or any other market. So by accident, I came up with this technology that started to be applied to Groupon, and I was actually forecasting, not actually forecasting, I was actually knowing the day the quarter ends, I knew what the top line revenue is, while Wall Street is guessing. So when they actually announced it 2 months later, I have a better picture than all these highly paid Wall Street analysts that were basically guessing, because I was actually being proactive collecting information. So I was doing this for a while, for about, you know, a year and a half, and then other dynamics enter in the market, and that approach doesn't work anymore, at least for this company. But it works for others. And that was back in 2012, I'm telling you. Right now, you have hedge funds like Two Sigma or, I don't know, 0.72, hiring data scientists to do this now. I'm telling you, the edge was 4 years ago or 5 years ago. Not right now, the edge is something completely different. So there is a little bit of a lag, you know, because usually the guys running these hedge funds are not technical guys, are not data scientists, they're just, you know, financial guys. And they hear the buzzwords and they start hiring people, and they're missing a lot of great opportunities by not being themselves data scientists or quants. I'm thinking that a data scientist or a quant, you know, with no domain expertise can magically produce results. That's what I'm seeing. But it's fascinating because it's, you know, it's creating opportunities for other people, and actually for my own company too.
And let's talk about your own company, SGX Analytics. You started it in 2016. So tell us a bit about the business itself, and, you know, are you still doing with the financial industry?
Well, this is the interesting part. So the company I started, the assets were acquired by a hedge fund. So it's basically 12 patents issued by the U.S. government. And these patents deal with data collection, analytics, etc. But, you know, there were a lot more inventions I had I never got to patent. So I find myself because of these patents and because a book that was published that talks about the top data scientists in the U.S., etc., I found myself in high demand from corporates in the U.S., and in other parts of the world for data science consulting work. So I started this company, SGX Analytics, which is basically advising anywhere from startups to Fortune 100 corporations in the two aspects: data strategy, which is different than data science and data science. Data science, better said, data strategy is basically a senior data scientist with quant background many times that with very little guidance knows where the value is in data stored in silos inside corporations. So, for example, there are corporations in the U.S., in Asia, in Europe that have tremendous value in data, and they don't even know how to monetize or what the value of the data is. So a data strategy comes, and immediately this person who has many years of experience and has worked for large corporations, who has done many data science experiments and models, knows, has a pretty good idea of where the value is. And that's the data strategy part. There is not much coding there. Actually, there is no coding there, but it's developing a data strategy for the monetization on the creation of value for corporations. And this is usually corporations, you know, not many startups need a data strategy. The data science aspect is the actual development of computer models and systems to extract the value of the data. And that maybe it's a new product, maybe there is something that gives you an edge in the stock market or not, etc. So right now I have clients that range from insurance companies to startups to hedge funds, to telecommunication companies, etc. And they are all looking at different aspects of their own data. But they do need the expertise of senior data scientists, senior quants, and sometimes IP specialists. How can we get protection, legal protection for these data and the tools to monetize the data, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I'm doing right now with SGX Analytics, and it's a very high demand. It's a fast, you know, very fast pace work. I mean, I'm traveling a lot of my time, you know, to the east, from the East Coast to the West Coast, to Europe, to Asia, et cetera.
And that's it for today's show. You've just heard Jessica McKellar and Luis Sanchez, keynote speakers for this year's PyCon APAC 2017 that's happening on the 26th and 27th of August in Kuala Lumpur. You've been listening to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.